A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Sometimes science goes too far.
Dark matters, twisted but true. Wednesdays at 10 on Science.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me at long last is Charles W. Chuck Bryant. And this is special, like 8 ways from Sunday. This episode is, isn't it?
I've changed my name over the weekend. That's new.
Yeah.
I changed to Jan Michael Vincent.
Finally.
I know, right?
You've been talking about that forever, Chuck. I'm glad you finally did it. And you showed me your driver's license, and it's official.
Pretty neat.
And what's cool is you did your hair for the photo.
I did.
And it looks kind of like the Airwolf era Jan Michael Vincent.
Is there any other era?
The Mechanic.
That's true.
Yeah. Those are his two eras.
Hooper.
Was he in that?
Yeah. He was the young buck stuntman to Burt Reynolds' aged veteran.
Oh, really? He played that role a couple of times then, I guess.
I guess so.
Huh. Okay, well, that's enough for the Jan Michael Vincent shout-outs. Is he around still?
I haven't seen him in a decade, and he was in pretty bad shape a decade ago.
Was he really?
Yeah.
From what?
I think drugs. I might be wrong, though. Or maybe he was...
I hope you're not wrong.
Maybe he was injured or something.
Because you just told everybody Jan Michael Vincent likes drugs.
He self-experimented.
Great one. Thank you very much for that. This is a special episode because we are good friends with the Science Channel, and they have a very, very cool show that an ad played for at the beginning of this episode.
That's right.
Dark Matters. Mm-hmm. It premiered last Wednesday. It comes on tomorrow, Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Have you looked at the episodes? Have you seen any of the video?
It's pretty awesome.
It is. And I was going through the episode guide of the stuff they have coming up. It's like... really, like a dark version of Unsolved Mysteries. You remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So a couple of the episodes have stuff that we've covered, like Einstein's brain, CIA LSD.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they have a bunch of stuff we haven't covered.
Are they ripping us off?
I didn't get that impression, but it's possible.
They can do anything they want.
But imitation is the greatest form of flattery,
that's right?
Right?
And that's actually, we get asked to do stuff sometimes, and you'll know if we really want to do it because we do it.
And we did this one, like, this is literally being recorded today.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
That is definitely different.
Yeah, Jerry's turning this one around. Like
hours later, or earlier, we recorded this.
It is as fresh as it gets. It still has the peach fuzz on it.
Depeche Mode, by the way.
Depeche Mode is in no way related to Erasure.
He was a founding member of Depeche Mode and later went on to found Erasure.
Really?
Vincent Clarke, yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Nice music.
I knew there was some tie.
I had no idea.
We're talking about this because we were having, rarely do we let you in on our pre-record conversation, but Josh went and saw Erasure this weekend, and I knew
it was awesome.
And it was great, and there was some tie to another band, and I couldn't remember it, and it was Depeche Mode.
It was either Depeche Mode or the Pet Boys.
Probably. Pet
Shop Boys. But I had, did I just say that?
You hear that? He said the Pet Boys, which is an auto parts store.
They're really good on the keyboards, and they have these gigantor heads and tiny bodies. All
right,
so Chuck, you ready?
Ready.
We're talking about scientists who self-experiment, and we've talked about crazy experiments before. So this episode actually forms a trifecta with two other previously released episodes that if you haven't heard, you should go listen to.
What's the third?
There is the human experimentation.
Yeah, sure.
episode, and then five crazy government experiments.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All those are pretty well mixed together. So if you listen to that, if you listen to those two in self-experimentation, you're going to have a very robust understanding of just how nuts some scientists are.
You know what they call that around here?
What?
A bucket.
Yeah, they do.
A bucket of content.
Heck, that's almost a channel.
That's right. This is good, man. You threw this together like lickety-split last week and found some really cool things, I think.
Yeah, there's you could do way more than 10.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Like the guy who cracked his own knuckles for 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
Just in his left hand, I believe.
And he found nothing, right?
It does not cause arthritis.
That's right.
We've talked before about Albert Hofmann, the Swiss chemist who took the world's first acid trip
on purpose. Yeah.
On a bike.
Boy, can you imagine, like, never having known anything about it? Like, I think generally when people do that kind of thing these days, you've heard of it and you know what's coming.
Sure.
But for it to be this brand new thing, he was probably like, I bet that was a long bike ride.
Yeah. Like, kids grew up on the Great Space Coaster, so they know it's coming, you know? But yeah, he said that, he laid down at home and, these bizarre but not altogether unpleasant visions started coming to him. And yeah, he was whacked out for many hours. But we've talked about him before. A guy who we haven't talked about, who I find just fascinating, is named Santorio Santorio. It's the researcher so nice, they named him twice.
Santorio Santorio?
Yes.
Yes.
Take it, Chuck.
Well, he was a self-experimenter and one of the earlier self-experimenters. We're talking 16th century style. And what he did is he wanted to find out about, and I guess they didn't call it metabolism at the time, did they?
No, he
it later ended
kicked
up
off
being...
the study.
Okay.
Yeah, back then they had no idea.
But basically, that's what he was doing, was kind of learning about the human metabolism, and he did so by being very meticulous about recording what he eated,
mm-hmm.
what he ate, the and what he drank, and weighing his stools and his urine.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he formed some equation, what comes in, what goes out.
Well, he found that it doesn't equal.
Well, sure.
And you can't take into account the weight you put on. There's still some difference. And he wanted to figure out where that went, and he came up with the idea of insensible perspiration.
Which I thought was going to be all about sweat, so I was a little disappointed.
Well, it is.
Yeah, but really?
I mean, it's just like constant little sweat.
I guess so.
You lose weight like that. But the cool thing about Santorio Squared is that he lived for 30 years, Chuck, essentially on
this
weighing machine.
He did this for 30 years?
Yeah, every day, every single day for 30 years. And he basically lived on this machine. It was like huge beam scale.
Uh-huh.
And he constructed like a little chair and like a work table and all that. And he weighed all the food and drink that came on, and he weighed all the poop and urine that went off. But he lived on this thing.
Well, and what's sad is that he did all this, and it really wasn't super useful.
No, but...
It opened the doors, though, for things like this.
It definitely did. Yeah. And one of the other things it did was he had the idea of insensible perspiration before he did this. So he was one of the first people to say, you know what? I'm not just going to say something. I'm going to subject this to scientific rigor.
I'm going to put my money where my mouth is.
I'm going to
put
live
my
on
weight
a,
poop.
A scale and weigh my poop. Yeah. He's like a stockbroker in the 80s looking for brand, you know?
So that's number one. Number two, we come to 1803. It was a little bit of a jump there to Friedrich Wilhelm Adam Sertürner.
Mm-hmm.
And what he ended up doing was actually pretty useful
for
everyone, even today.
Yes.
Because he... Did he discover morphine?
He isolated it.
Isolated it from opium.
Yeah.
And
through 52 steps.
Got a few friends together. Well, first he tested it on animals until they started dying.
Yeah.
Sleeping then dying.
Right. And then he's like, well, maybe I should try this on people and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because he said that animals do not give exact results.
That's true.
Right. So he and his 17-year-old friends give exact results.
Although dying is a pretty exact result.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So he OD'd a bunch of animals, then he got three, you pointed out, 17-year-olds, plus himself.
I think he was like 20 at the time.
He was?
So that's like right in the wheelhouse still today, I think.
Yeah, he's middle-aged back then, though.
Yeah.
And so he dosed himself and his friends on a low dose at first, about a half a grain of morphine, which is 30 mg.
Well, yeah, it's a comparatively low dose to what he took.
Right. And that produced a little flushing. He was like, hey, this is kind of neat, but I'm looking for more than flushing, so let me take a little more.
Yeah.
After about 15 minutes, took a similar dose. Started feeling a little queasy and faint and sleepy, of course.
Yeah.
And to the point where I guess he thought it might be getting a little dangerous, so he threw up, made all his friends throw up to get it out of their system.
Well, yeah, he started to get a little worried that they were all going to die because
like
they'd
the
taken
dogs.
90 milligrams of morphine in less than an hour, which today we realize is 10 times the recommended
yeah,
dose.
Exactly.
So, yeah, he gave everybody like 8 ounces of vinegar to drink and made them throw up and save their lives.
Yeah, I imagine they probably would have OD'd, huh?
Yeah. And then he did another experiment later because he had a toothache, and he found that if he just took opium for it, the toothache wasn't cured, but if he took some morphine, it was cured.
Oh, I thought he discovered that by accident. Like, he was like, wait a minute, my toothache's gone.
No, he kept going. This is okay. Not the only experiment. Like, he
gotcha.
Had, like, many, many brushes with death. As far as self-experimenting scientists go, he was probably one of the toughest ones.
Or at least... Or the most one, able to take a lot of drugs.
Right, the one most addicted to morphine.
That's right.
Yeah. But that was a pretty big contribution to humanity, morphine.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's still like the go-to painkiller today.
I imagine.
Yeah.
Or not imagine. I know this to be true. Up next, Josh, we have Henry Head, Sir Henry Head. And he got together with his buddy W.H.R. Rivers. And this one's a little crazy to me. They knew at the time that nerve damage can repair itself, but what they didn't have was documentation.
Right, because
people couldn't describe it good enough.
Right,
apparently.
They'd be like, yeah, I guess that kind of hurts.
Yeah, and like, yeah, so what they needed at the time, there was no documentation, so they were like, well, let me cut out a sliver of my nerve on my arm and sew it back together, and since I can talk about this stuff mm-hmm. intelligently, just I'll do it myself.
Yeah, and not just any nerve. This is a radial. The radial nerve in his left arm, right? He was right-handed, which is why he did this to his left arm, because he's no dummy.
At least he did that. No, he's no dummy.
Right. And he had it surgically removed. And the radial nerve, dude, goes to the spinal column.
Oh,
and
really?
Then all the way down, branches all the way down to the hand. So it's like a major nerve. And
yeah.
He had a section cut out and then tied back together with silk. And then said, okay, I'm going to spend the next 5 years paying attention to how the sensation, somatoception, comes back.
That's right.
And not only that, Chuck, so, dude, I got a root canal the other day, as you know.
Yeah, you said it wasn't too bad, huh?
No, it wasn't. But I was thinking about Henry Head because while it was going on, I kind of went off to my happy place. I just, like, left mm-hmm. my body as much as possible.
Yeah.
In case any pain did come along, it would be kind of muted. What Henry Head did...
Did that work?
Was it did, okay. Yeah. You know, like, you're not looking for the pain. You're trying to avoid it mentally.
Yeah, and it definitely makes it worse if you're thinking
paying
about
attention,
the pain.
Yes. Yeah. But what Henry Head did was create this kind of trance-like state called negative attitude of attention. Where he focused his attention inward on pain, looking for it, so he could, you know, I guess experience it more fully.
Right.
And pay attention to the type of pain it was. So this guy went on this journey of pain, excruciating pain at times.
Yeah. He told his wife that.
Yeah.
What was his quote to his wife?
He said, I shall know a great deal about pain by the yeah. time this experiment is over.
Yeah.
And he was
like,
right.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. But he was a bad dude.
She was like, what's this bringing in? Are they paying you for this?
Eternal fame.
But he, you know, that documentation was important because they'd never been able to describe fully. They probably didn't follow patients up like they do now, you
right.
know, like 5 years later.
Right. Well, and this was over the course of 5 years. So, like, they basically documented how sensation returns after major nerve damage. And he also contributed a lot to experimental psychology with the negative attitude of attention. Basically, there's this whole thing of reverie where you're just basically zoned out, like Ralphie in A Christmas Story. Like, that was never documented before. And basically what Henry Head did was say, oh, here's a way to explore that.
I don't get the Ralphie.
Remember like, where they're like, Ralphie, and he like comes to?
Oh, okay.
Remember his little daydream about getting the A++++++?
Yeah, yeah.
Plus? That's reverie.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good family comedy. That's what
yeah.
that is.
Yes, it is.
Number 4 on our list, Josh, I like to call the dude who loved drugs, Alexander Shulgin. We talked about him before, and he was a chemist for Dow in the 60s.
We talked about him in the Ken Psychedelics Treat Mental Illness. That's the one he showed up in.
Right. He was basically toying with mescaline and compounds that later became ecstasy, MDMA. MDMA.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I have a hard time saying that. And he and his wife took a lot of these psychoactive drugs, had parties, and the martini, as the usual method of the 60s.
Yep.
Put a little drugs in there. And, you know, that's basically his story.
He liked the drugs.
And I guess he documented all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't just partying, was he?
I don't know if partying's the right word, but I don't know that he was always documenting. I don't know if it was always scientifically rigorous.
How many did he take here?
So there's like an estimated 300 psychoactive compounds in the world, and he estimated that he sampled between 200 and 250 of them.
Wow.
So he liked the psychedelics a lot. He was big time into the Dead.
Timothy Leary to shame, didn't he?
They were probably buddies.
Was he American?
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's go back a little bit from the drug-addled 60s.
To the drug-addled 19th century?
Yeah, 1819, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a Czechoslovakian monk who at age 32 became a doctor because he didn't think that the whole recommended dosage thing that was being doled out at the time was, he called it nothing but mysticism. He thought it was way too low and basically homeopathy.
Right.
I think he had a problem with homeopathy. His name was Jan Purkinje. And he basically said, okay, I'm going to become a doctor so I can learn more about this. And then I'm going to take as many drugs as I can get my hands on and overdose and then pay attention to what happens to me.
That's right.
Because I want to figure out what the recommended dosage should be.
Yeah, the coolest part about this guy's story, I think, is that after he started doing this, like taking things like foxglove
mm-hmm.
to blur his vision and then writing about that, nightshade, the word got out and I got the sense that other doctors were like, hey, there's this dude that he'll let you do anything to him.
Right. He'll take anything.
So they started doing that.
Yeah. One of his teachers at med school said, hey, I've got these three different extracts of Ipecac and I need to find out which one's best. So what do you think?
Which one? Is there anything that does besides make you vomit?
Nope.
Okay. That's its sole purpose?
Yep. As far as I know, that's it.
Have you ever had it?
I've never heard of it used for anything else. No.
I haven't either.
No, I don't ever want to have it. But
I want to try it.
So Jan Purkinje conducted a three-week trial of these three extracts of Ipecac. And by the end of the trial, he'd conditioned like a vomiting response where whenever he saw like a brown powder that looked like Ipecac, he'd just
bleh. Yeah. His wife's like, you want some cinnamon toast?
Well, you know, it's interesting. His wife died, and he became in charge of raising his three boys. And he said, okay, I'm not self-experimenting anymore. I have to stick around to take care of these jokers.
That's good to know.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. He said he was leaving it to the younger generation.
So he started.
But he'd been doing it for 20 years already.
Right.
And not just Ipecac and foxglove, but also nightshade. We now use atropine, which is the active ingredient in nightshade, to dilate pupils thanks to him because he overdosed on nightshade to find out what would happen.
And he would also make himself very dizzy to study vertigo
mm-hmm.
on carousels.
Yeah, there's a type of vertigo named after him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he studied it and figured it out.
So he would just like get on the carousel until and then stand up and...
Yeah, but rather than... And this is a common thread in self-experimentation. Like with my root canal, or if you're dizzy on a carousel, you go inward, you shy away from it. You don't want to pay attention to any details. You just want everything to end, right?
Yeah.
What self-experimenting researchers do is throw themselves into the experience and pay attention
mm-hmm.
and gain all that knowledge from it that, you know, any one of us could do if we were good at describing things scientifically.
Yeah, true.
But we don't because we want to avoid pain and discomfort and nausea and Ipecac.
These guys did it for us.
They did.
Thankfully.
Yeah. Well, that's why we're doing this one, too. It's like hats off to them if you haven't gotten that impression yet. Thank you.
Hats off.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
I'm Elia Kani, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What if I just did that and I had like a reverse mohawk or something? And I like, you couldn't say anything about it. All right, George Stratton is next. And he did something a little crazy. You know, he wore reversing lenses in the 1890s. So he learned that our visual information comes in an inverted manner. We all know this.
Right. Well, he knew that. But there were theories that said that's how it has to be. And he wanted to find out if that was true. Like, does visual information have to be inverted for us to see upright? Because, you know, it flips over in the brain.
Exactly.
Right?
So can you imagine what he did to his brain by doing this?
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
He wore these reversing lenses, which basically presented visual information right side up, and wore them for 8 days straight.
So it provided it right side up to the brain, but if we wore that, everything would look upside down.
Yeah.
And he did. He, like you said, 8 days straight.
Unbelievable.
He said the thing that got him the most was he would put his hand out.
Moving?
Right. Well, he had to just sit there for the first 4 days. He couldn't move at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But he would stretch his hand out and it would come in from the top rather than the bottom. Wow. And he said everything was just like a dream.
I'd like to try that out for a second. You know, I'd just like to put some on and be like, oh.
Right.
That's weird. Let me take them right back off.
Exactly. Not leave them on for 8 days.
No.
Apparently by the fifth day, everything started to show up as upright again.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then if you really concentrated on it, it would go back to being upside down. But
so did he rewire his brain?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He proved that the visual information doesn't have to be inverted to be seen upright. And that the brain is really capable of adapting in a fairly short time to basically the most radical changes in the sensations it's presented.
So I guess that's sort of helped. I mean, it's not like that led to any huge breakthrough, though, did it?
I think it probably gave, I would think that it probably formed the basis of neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
Surely.
All right.
Yeah. Plus also, I mean, anybody who does that, that's mind bending, you know?
Yeah.
He gets a pat on the back for that, no matter what.
Well, and he also found, too, that after taking them off, that it took a little while to get back to normal, which probably says something, too, about how your brain unlearns.
Yeah.
I bet his brain was ticked off.
Yeah, he said that he had, glasses at first, and he said it was just too much. He couldn't do it. So he blindfolded one eye for 8 days and had, basically a monocle, a little single lens. And that's the one he wore for 8 days. He said it was just too much to have two lenses. So you want to do Carl Landsteiner?
He actually did do a lot of good work. He was Viennese, and he was a physician. And he basically came up with the blood typing system, the ABO blood typing system, because he noticed that red blood cells in some people clump in the presence of the fluid component, which is serum, but not everybody. So he thought, it's almost as if their blood is a different type from one another.
Well, at the time, like, they knew that that would happen because you give people blood transfusions and then they die, and you'd look
was
at their
it because
blood,
of the blood
and it was
type?
Clumped. Yeah. But at the time, everybody thought it was because those people had some unknown disease. And Lonsteiner was like, I think that people just have different types of blood. So he used his own blood and some of his colleagues.
We should do one on blood type.
I think we should.
Is that true? Like, your body cannot accept another blood type?
It depends. I think O is the universal type.
Yeah.
So you can accept O.
But if you have, like, A, you can't have B at all?
No, because the red blood cells clump and your blood doesn't flow and you die.
So it's like putting diesel in a...
Very much so.
In a regular engine.
Very much so, yeah.
Wow.
So what, like you said, what Lonsteiner did was a huge contribution because he showed, there's different antigens in different types of blood, and that creates this different blood type, A, B, O, or AB.
Yeah.
And if you test people first and say, oh, they're A type.
Right.
And we've got some A type blood over here, a blood transfusion will work. And so will organ donation and all this other
stuff. Huge.
Yeah. It was enormous.
I bet doctors were like, oh, well, that's good to know.
Right. Yeah.
All
you need to stop putting
now.
Diesel in these people. So yeah, he won the Nobel Prize in 1930 for that.
And oh, did he?
Rightly so, yeah.
He should win it every year.
But what's crazy is, he experimented on himself. It's kind of cool. But what's nuts is that he also uses colleagues' blood, and it just so happened that out of like five people, they all had different blood types. Like all blood types were present. It could have gone the exact opposite way.
Right.
And just everybody had A type.
And then he said, no, they're the same.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was pretty cool. It was almost a providence.
Well, and he led to Dr. Jack Goldstein in the 1980s to do, he was a biochemist that did more experimenting. And this one confused me, but he found out that an enzyme in coffee, mm-hmm. when injected into bee blood, removes antigen and basically makes it the universal blood type.
Right.
How did he figure that out?
I don't know.
The coffee thing coming.
I don't know, but he figured it out.
But he's like, I just injected coffee one day to see what that would do.
Right.
Into my blood.
Right. So he had O type blood. So this enzyme changes B type blood to O type blood. And he had O type blood. So to prove that this worked, he got a blood transfusion of this treated B blood that was ostensibly now O blood.
Right.
So he got a blood transfusion, a small one, but he did it himself. To see if, his arm would fall off or something like that, or if his blood would clump. And it worked.
Right.
And it's still being worked out, but apparently, that opens up, like, the donation pool.
Sure.
If you can just take all this B-type blood and you need O, which is the universal type, just inject it with this enzyme and...
I wonder how much blood you have to have transfused before it, like, how much diesel can you put in there?
I don't know.
Like, if they just did like a vial, would that, like, what would that do to your body?
I don't know. Cause Goldstein did like 11.5 billion red blood cells.
Right.
And I don't know if that's just a few drops or if that's like half a pint or
yeah.
what.
And, I'm curious.
Yeah.
All right. We'll
have to find that out in the blood typing episode. Okay.
Well, I've been wanting to do the blood one for a while, but it's just like,
let's do it right now.
It's tough. I'm going to need a little while on that one.
Okay.
Okay.
Do we have a blood typing article?
Well, we have an article on blood that's like really dense.
Oh, yes. We started to do that one and we're like, yeah, we're not doing this right now.
Yeah, it was much more complex than I thought.
I think it was written by an MD, wasn't it?
It read like it.
Yeah. So look for the revised version coming in the future.
All right. I like number 9.
Ebbinghaus?
Hermann. Is it Hermann or Hermann Ebbinghaus?
I don't think he's Portuguese.
He was a German. Would Hermann be Portuguese?
Yeah, Hermann?
I don't know. He's Hermann then. Let's just call him Hermann.
Okay.
He was German, and he was the first guy to really study memory in a really, maybe at all, but in a really scientific way,
mm-hmm.
which was unusual at the time to apply scientific research principles to psychological matters.
Right. It was like basically taking the way the hard science is doing it and applying it to the soft science of psychology.
That's right.
But he formed the methodology that's still in use today and proved that it can work. Like, yes, you can study, cognitive faculties like memory.
In a science way. In a science way. Science-y way.
Mm-hmm.
So what he did was pretty cool. He created, first thing he did was he created these non-syllable nonsense syllables, 2,300 of them, mm-hmm. with two consonants with a vowel in the middle, like nog is one example you used.
Yeah.
And he had to make them nonsense because there had to be, like, no association with, like, previous words that he had learned. They had to be brand new things in his brain.
Right. Because, I mean, if you have a previous association with a syllable, right, like skay, okay,
sure.
And you have a great memory of ice skating as a child, and skay brings that to mind, of course you're going to remember skay.
I'm surprised he came up with 2,300 of them.
I know.
That'd be tough for me. So what he did was he basically, over the course of a year, learned these words, and then to the point where he could recall them perfectly, and then recorded how long it took for him basically to forget them and then relearn them again.
Right.
And that taught us all sorts of cool things about memory.
Yeah, he figured out that, and a lot of this stuff, you know, is so commonplace, we know it. We take it very much for granted, but this guy is the one who figured out that meaningless stuff is harder to learn than meaningful stuff.
Yeah.
He gave us the idea of the learning curve. The more stuff you have to learn, the longer it's going to take to learn it.
Yeah, I think he was the first person to actually name it, too, the learning curve.
I think so. It's possible.
I believe so.
Okay. Forgetting happens most rapidly right after learning and then kind of evens off and slows down.
Yeah.
And he taught us that cramming doesn't work, that learning is best when it's done over a longer time than, you know, a single
true learning
session. Yeah.
Because, boy, I used to cram pretty well.
Did you? Yeah. I stunk at it.
I was good at it.
I was not. I would just be too stressed out.
Well, and I shortchanged myself, though, because I would do well on the test and then forget it. Which was, I mean, I wasn't doing myself any favors as far as gaining knowledge, you know.
I took Italian in college, and it was the only language that's ever clicked for me. Like, I got Italian on a fundamental level.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and just aced the class until the final.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied for the final. I don't think I crammed. I just, you know, I didn't take it for granted that I was going to ace the final. But I, for some reason, I got there and forgot everything.
And
when I sat down... And, well, then I panicked, yeah. But it wasn't panic until I realized that I'd forgotten everything. And I still to this day don't understand what happened. And I don't remember. It's not like it came back after the test. It just went away right before the final.
You know what happened?
What?
A centorio centorio. That's what happened.
I started weighing my feces, and it chased away all my understanding of Italian.
And I stopped after one trial.
Did you? Quitter? No.
I'm just saying, I've weighed my feces once, and
I know you got to do it more than once.
He also created the Ebbinghaus illusion. Have you ever heard of that? That's that thing right there.
Is it the same size?
Yeah,
that is not the same size.
It is.
It is not the same size.
It's a very famous illusion where there are two same-sized circles.
They're not the same size.
And then the one on the left has these very large circles around it, and the one on the right has very small circles around it, and it gives the appearance that they're different sizes, but they are not.
So Ebbinghaus is a pioneer in experimental psychology, which is pretty cool.
Absolutely.
And in experimental psychology, still today, self-experimentation is fairly commonly used because it's not nearly as dangerous as it is in, say, medicine. And
sure.
For that reason, science today is basically like you can't self-experiment. That's so 19th century.
Well, and beyond the dangers of it, there's something called double blinds and mm-hmm. placebos that, you know, if you're self-experimenting, then that's going to affect the outcome of the experiment.
Right.
Almost 100% of the time, I would think.
The double blind is like a hallmark of scientific inquiry, and it's impossible when you're experimenting on yourself.
It's true.
So... if you're looking for grant funding and you're saying, well, I'm just going to try this drug on myself and see what happens, you're not going to get that funding. But
probably won't get published either, right?
Well, it depends. There's this guy named Seth Roberts who published a paper about his 12 years of self-experimentation. And he's a psychologist. But the paper that he published was about the self-experimenting he did in his spare time. So if you're not an experimental psychologist, probably, if you're into self-experimentation, you're either some sort of pro scientist mm-hmm. doing it in your spare time,
right.
Or you're an amateur. There's been a movement called N equals one, which is, you know, N is scientific notation for the study sample size or population size.
Isn't it called quantified self, though? That's the movement?
Well, that's the website. There's like a group where it's kind of like this hub of like, hey, I wanted to figure out why I had migraines, so I started tracking like my food and
there were Wired editors, I think,
who founded Quantified Self.
Yeah,
yeah, I did not know that.
Well, yeah,
yeah. So there's a quantifiedself.com is basically this awesome place where you can go see how other people are carrying out their own self experiments and
gets a little wacky.
Yeah,
there's this one lady that drinks her first urine of the day each day.
That is wacky.
She records all that.
Are you sure you saw that?
I read it. I didn't see her do that.
Well,
yeah. But yeah.
You didn't click on the YouTube link?
No, there's all sort. There was a big
I did not
Forbes.
See that one.
Yeah, Forbes had a big article on this movement, which is some people call it navel gazing at its finest.
Yeah.
Other people think it's valid.
Well, that's the point that Seth Roberts made. He was saying, like, I don't need funding for this because I'm just doing it in my spare time. It costs like basically no money.
Get off my back.
I just pay attention.
Yeah.
But he also said that he was he had the motivation of a person looking to solve a problem. Like he wanted to control his weight or mood or make himself a happier person or get better sleep. So he just carried out all these self-experiments and he could conduct more than one at a time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was like, get off my back.
I think it's kind of cool though. Like I have lactose issues and I could see myself getting into eating to tracking that and isolating exactly which foods. I mean, that's basically all it is.
That's it.
It's kind of cool.
And drinking your own urine.
I will draw the line there.
So we should probably say thanks to some of the sources that helped us with this podcast.
Josh Clark.
Oscillatory Thoughts blog. Let's see. Tiffany Watt Smith wrote Henry Head in the Theater of Reverie. Scientific American had a cool article, Self-Experiment or Step Up for Science. Alan Neuringer had a paper from 1981 called Self-Experimentation, A Call for Change. Lawrence K. Altman literally wrote the book on this. Who Goes First? The Story of Self-Experimentation in Medicine.
Who Goes First?
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty funny.
A. Cohen wrote an article in the British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology about Sairturner's experiments, he and his good time buddies. Salvatore Curari.
Did he write about Centorio Centorio?
He wrote about George Stratton.
Ah.
The University of Indiana has a cool human intelligence department. QuantifiedSelf.com if you want to get into self-experimentation and don't feel like suing us for mentioning it.
It's interesting to look at the very least.
Yeah, agreed. And then Seth Roberts, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of My Self-Experimentation is the name of the paper. So those are all the ones. And then pretty soon there'll be a list, a top 10 list on the site. It's not published yet.
It's practically done, I would assume.
And Chuck, if you forgot the name of the show that we were promoting on Science Channel, why don't we do a little ad for it?
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's true. Yeah. Chuck, a couple more shout-outs. Our good friend Wyatt Cenac.
Yes.
His stand-up special, Wyatt Cenac Comedy Person, is out on DVD.
Very funny stuff.
Yes.
And if you've only seen Wyatt on The Daily Show, he is he's great on The Daily Show, but his stand-up is hysterical and different than you would think it would be.
It is.
He's much more like lively and animated. And
yeah, he's awesome. Yeah, he's a good guy, too. And we have a happiness audiobook out.
That's right.
The Grammy-nominated happiness audiobook, the yeah. Super Stuff Guide to Happiness.
That's right.
It's up on iTunes for $3.99. You're going to end up shelling out more if you're in Australia. We're sorry. Let's see what else. Oh, it's got all sorts of great sound design interviews.
Yeah.
It's just cool.
We got some experts on the horn.
Yep. My niece.
Yes.
Starts it out.
She let it off.
It's up on iTunes. Just search for Super Stuff Guide to Happiness. And that will also bring up the Super Stuff Guide to the Economy, which is still evergreen and good.
Are we going
to
do any more of those?
I think we should.
We should.
Okay,
I would feel like a quitter if we just had two.
Yeah. We need at least three. I would like four at least.
Okay.
And then one more administrative detail. We have a cool little thing. If you text SYSK to 80565, it texts you back a link to listen to the podcast on your iPhone without going through iTunes if you're not in the mood.
Is that what that did?
Yeah.
I didn't do that.
It's cool. It brings up our RSS feed, and you can just listen to it. I think it's QuickTime, so it'll work on your iPhone or your Droid or whatever.
That's our latest marketing invention.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So just text SYSK to 80565 if you ever are having a Stuff You Should Know Jones.
That's right.
Friedrich Sir Turner's not around.
Yeah, and by the way, we're working on, there's been some issues with the apps, I think, refreshing the podcast list lately. And we are working, our tech department is working on that. So keep your pants on, as they say.
Yeah. So this will be up eventually. You can look for 10 scientists who were their own guinea pigs.
Love it.
In the search bar at howstuffworks.com. You can also type in human experimentation and 5 crazy government experiments, and they'll bring up those articles. And I said, handy search bar, finally, somewhere in there, which means it's time for listener mail.
Josh, I'm going to call this, first of all, quickly, if you're from Berkeley, California, and you went to UC Berkeley,
yeah.
We had a slight slip of the tongue.
Seriously?
We said UCLA Berkeley. We know it's UC Berkeley. We know UCLA is in Los Angeles.
Yes.
It was just a little slip of the tongue.
That's it. We're not dummies.
No, we're not dummies.
And also,
that happens sometimes.
If you live in or have been to Nederland, Colorado, and are a fan of the Frozen Dead Guy days and are mad we didn't bring it up in our Cryonics episode, go listen to 10 Odd Town Festivals.
That's right. It's in there.
It's in there.
All right, so back to the listener mail. This is from Stephen H., and this was just cool information. I'm a huge fan of the show, guys. Love the depth and breadth of the presentations. I'm not sure how far I am from this week. He's pretty far. But I just listened to the Black Death episode. I thought you might be interested to know, while the plague was a horrible affair with millions of deaths and an interesting effect on our language today, many scholars of the history of the English language, myself included, hold that the plague in England is a major reason why we write in English today. You see, after the Normans, which were French Vikings, took England at the Battle of Hastings in 1066, Anglo-Norman French and Latin became the two major languages of administration and literature, because all the important rich folks were French, spoke mm-hmm. French.
Okay.
However, for reasons unknown, the plague seems to have hit the mid-range nobility harder than other groups, resulting in a desperate need for administrators. The only people left to fill the jobs were regular Joes who only spoke English. So the theory goes that because of the plague, the nobility was forced to learn English to communicate with their administrators, resulting in the reemergence of English as the language of law, administration, and literature.
Mm-hmm.
From Stephen H.
Nice.
Pretty neato.
Yeah.
I love supplemental information. Those are my favorite ones.
I do too. So thanks a lot, Stephen H. Since Chuck's such a big fan of supplemental information, if you have any supplemental information about experimentation, specifically self-experimentation, we want to hear it.
Yeah, if you've done this yourself, I'd like to hear about it.
Yeah, but don't do it yourself just to tell us about it.
No, because we don't want anyone getting hurt.
That seems like in the gray area that I'm not comfortable with.
But if you've done, like, your own lactose study on yourself, something like that.
Sure.
Something harmless.
Yeah, like you didn't inject lactose.
No.
You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can go on to facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. That's our page. Or you can send us a plain old-fashioned email to stuffpodcasts@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.